Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, ignition.
Major Garrett.
Yes, CBS.
Yes, hi.
Ladies and gentlemen,
please welcome Major Garrett
from the nation's capital.
Major, fantastic.
It's The Takeout.
Major.
With CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent.
Major, that's nonsense.
Major Garrett.
And you should know better.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett, host and creator of this program known as The Takeout. Politics, policy, pop culture, all of it wrapped up with one guest, unedited. That's the big commitment I make to you, everyone in this audience. What I say maybe get edited for time, but never our guests. We never have a post-show conversation about someone being taken out of context. What they say is what you hear. That's my commitment to you. Our guest this week, you probably have heard of him, Joe Lieberman. Yes, he was the vice presidential nominee of the Democratic Party, along with presidential nominee Al Gore in 2000. They were actually in a presidential race that was very close and legally contested, as opposed to the 2020 race, which by all statistical measurements, wasn't that close and should not have been contested. We'll get into that, I assure you. Senator Lieberman, it's great to see you. How are you? How are you doing?
Good to be with you, Major. Thanks. I'm doing really well. I mean, I'm like everybody else. I'm hoping and praying for the end of the pandemic as soon as possible. But other than that, life is good.
So I will speak for you. I say this almost every show, and I think I can speak for you in this. I am enormously privileged to be able to do the work I do as I do it, meaning from home. We've been doing this show from my dining room, Zoom room, since mid-March. As you may or may not know, Senator Lieberman, this show was built around taking this conversation into restaurants all over the country, mostly in D.C., but we've taken it on the road because I always wanted the idea of an atmosphere of a restaurant because I thought it would make the conversation better. It would enhance it, and sure enough, it did. Not possible during the pandemic, but nevertheless, the work I do, I can do from home, and I've been able to do from home, and I understand what an enormous advantage slash privilege that is in this time. And lots of Americans don't have that advantage, don't have that privilege, and I say this to them every show, if I can remember, thank you. And we're thinking of you, and we're trying to behaviorally do the things to put you at minimum risk.
Right.
So I'll say that on both of our behalves.
No, that's well said. Let me just, since you've got a little time,
Sure.
I totally agree with you. Secondly, I look forward to the end of the pandemic because you can go out to the restaurants like you wanted to. And I want to tell you that when I started my Senate career, I was looking for a way to connect with people. And I started to do town hall meetings, if you will. And a lot of the times they were dominated by people who were in interest groups that already were coming to see me in Washington. So I said, this is not what I want. This is not real people. So we got the idea to start visiting diners in Connecticut, and because it was a very comfortable atmosphere in which to talk to people. I don't mean everybody agreed with me and had nice things to say, but at least I was just randomly meeting regular people in the diner, and they were very good conversations. I used to say that I don't know why I'm paying my pollster to tell me what the public thinks. I'm getting it for nothing except the cost of a cup of coffee from the people in the diner. So I look forward to having you go back to the restaurants.
No doubt. No doubt. So one of the things we're going to talk about in this episode is Joe Lieberman's work along with Tom Ridge, who's been a guest on this show a couple years ago, on something called the Bipartisan Commission on Biodefense. And Senator Lieberman is going to have an I told you so moment that I'm sure he will indulge and embrace in because they've just put out a new report. They have a previous report that indicated a lot of things we should do that if we had done them before this pandemic arrived, we would be much better off. I promise we'll get to that topic in the not too distant future. But the first thing I want to talk about, Senator Lieberman, is what's going on in Washington on several fronts. Let's just talk about impeachment. From your vantage point, knowing the Senate as you do, casting important votes as you did, being an important interlocutor for the entire Democratic Party during the impeachment process of Bill Clinton, should Donald Trump, even though he's been he's left office, be impeached?
Well, I think that it looks like the votes are not there to convict him. But I think what happened after the election, and particularly after the Electoral College met and voted in the states for Joe Biden to be the next president of the United States, that President Trump's behavior really was a challenge to the constitutional order about how elections are decided. I'm not a great fan of the Electoral College, as you may remember. Al Gore and I would have been elected if it hadn't been for the Electoral College. But that's the law. That's the Constitution. So and then the mob attack on the Capitol on January 6th was just a low point in American history. So I think the House was right to impeach President Trump. And I do think it's right for the Senate to hold a trial. Incidentally, the vote the other day did in the Senate. There were only five Republicans who voted sort of against President Trump, if I can put it that way. It does, in my opinion, establish another precedent that says that a federal official, including the president, can be tried on a charge of impeachment even after that person leaves office. That's a significant historic contribution based on how extreme events were that led to this. We'll see what happens. It doesn't look to me like there are enough votes to convict President Trump. I hope in the end, if there's not a conviction, that the bipartisan work being done by Senator Susan Collins and Senator Tim Kaine to ask for a censure of the president for his behavior does end up in a bipartisan unifying statement against his behavior after the election.
If you were in the Senate, would you vote to convict?
The hard answer to that, that is the definitive answer, is probably I would wait and see what the evidence is at the trial. But right now, I would say I would be disposed to vote to convict, yes. And the main effect there is to have a statement for history, for the future, really, not so much for the past, that the behavior that President Trump, no matter what you think about him or I think about him in terms of this policy or that, I agreed with some, I disagreed with others, his behavior with regard to the election was really unacceptable. And transfer of power, unacceptable. So I would be, right now, I would say I'd be inclined to vote to convict and therefore prohibit him as a next step from ever holding federal office again.
Right. That would be the second vote if there was a vote to convict. Right. And you can't get to that second vote unless you get to that vote of conviction. And as you said earlier this week, there was a Senate question put to the floor. Is this impeachment process constitutional? Only five Republicans said yes, it would be constitutional to conduct this trial after the president leaves office. That was the procedural question. It seemed to me, Senator Lieberman, that was the Republicans' way to try to dodge the underlying question if they can. Let's have a process argument so we don't have to confront the ugly reality of what happened on January 6th and the rhetoric of the president that led to it.
Yeah, I agree in their heart of hearts that that at least half the Republicans, maybe in the Senate, maybe a majority, find President Trump's behavior unacceptable and really unconstitutional against the spirit of the Constitution. But, you know, they're facing a real political dilemma, and I understand that. As you know, and I think everybody's learned, impeachments understandably tend to be very partisan. So that the voting of the articles of impeachment against President Trump this time in the House, which had, I think, 10 Republicans voting for the charges, essentially, was the most bipartisan vote on impeachment in our history. It wasn't very bipartisan, but it was the most bipartisan ever. So that's the way it is.
You, if I heard you correctly, are inclined to support censure, but only after the trial itself hasn't rendered a conviction. You don't want to short circuit that by going straight to censure.
No, I think what happened here was serious enough, leading to the mob attack on the Capitol, and people were killed, died as a result of what happened. And there was really an attempt to stop the election of a person who was elected according to the Constitution and law to be the next president of the United States. That is so much without precedent in our history that I think that a trial has to be held. And if there's not enough votes for conviction when it's over, then I think there ought to be a bipartisan statement of censure of President Trump for his behavior in regard to the election.
Very good. That's the voice of Senator Joe Lieberman, our special guest here at The Takeout. Stay tuned for segment two in just a second.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
From CBS News, this is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Welcome back, Senator Joe Lieberman, our special guest, continuing our conversation about impeachment and the insurrection and things related to it. Where were you that day, and what did you think when you saw it unfold, January 6th?
January 6th, well, I was where, I've been most of the time since March 12th, right here in the apartment in which my wife and I live. So I was working at my desk. I was involved in Zoom meetings, and I saw a notice come across on my smartphone. That something was happening. I knew there was going to be a rally, but I saw that there was a march to the Capitol, and that appeared to be a disruption. And then, of course, I turned on the TV, and I was shocked, really. It was just it was a nightmare to watch that happen. And, of course, for me, because I worked in that building for 24 years, I revere the building. It's a beautiful building. It is, you know, and it sounds trite, but it is the citadel of our democracy. I was thinking about how often I would see tours of people from around the country going through the Capitol, and they're almost hushed. I mean, they really act in a very respectful way because they sense that they're in the middle of history and where our democracy functions or doesn't function. So it was shocking, really, very shocking.
I've said several times on this show, I consider it the most beautiful building in America. It was the great privilege of my early career in Washington to spend more than a decade covering Congress, House, and Senate. And I want to relate an experience, and I'm not trying to be odd when I relate this, but I want to see if you have anything that's similar to it. There would be times when I would be covering late-night negotiations, 11, 12, 1 in the morning, and I would walk from the House side to the Senate side. The Capitol is empty, except for a few reporters and a few lawmakers. And I would walk through that rotunda very late at night in that hushed quiet you described, Senator, and it was almost as if I could hear whispers of the past in that rotunda. And it was an overwhelming and moving experience for me. I wonder if you ever had anything like that, feeling the presence of the Capitol and its history around you.
All the time. I mean, you just gave me an association. I'll give you an odd reaction. When I started law school, I went to Yale. I had a young professor then, Guido Calabresi. He was tough then. He got a little calmer as time went on. So he said, if you ever get stressed out here at law school, cross the street to the Grove Street Cemetery. And there are some, it's a beautiful place, and there's some historic figures there. Roger Sherman, who represented Connecticut at the Constitutional Convention, Eli Whitney and the Cotton Gin, blah, blah, blah. But I used to think of that because there were times when we were in long sessions, particularly at night, just as you said, nobody really, no tourists in the building or anything. And in between votes, you could go back to your hideaway. I did that some, I was working. Go to the cloakroom, a schmooze with your colleagues. But sometimes I would just walk into that rotunda and just feel history all around, statues of people from all the states. Beautiful, look up at that dome from inside, unbelievable. So I don't find your story odd at all. And it was very therapeutic. I mean, it is a beautiful building. It's a beautifully design building, even the construction of it is kind of remarkably historic. So thank you for telling that story.
So you were the first chairman, I believe, of the Committee on Homeland Security in the Senate. You helped draft the legislation that created the Department of Homeland Security after 9/11. Yeah. You spent a good time focused on the threats to America of extremist-influenced terrorism from outside our shores. Did you ever imagine, as you were doing that work and as you tried to make sure government called it what it was, you would be in a position where you would, I believe, recommend to our country, as the FBI said yesterday, we need a terrorism alert about extremism within our country. It is white supremacist, it is anti-Semitic, and it is real.
Yeah, no, it is shocking. I mean, let's go back, because in the 90s, we began to confront both foreign-based terrorism, particularly Islamic terrorism, and even here in the U.S., like in 1993, Al-Qaeda tried a truck bomb in the World Trade Center. Did some damage, but thank God nothing like happened on 9/11. But the real change in our attitude in America was, I believe it was 1998 with the Oklahoma City bombing, which was a federal building, which was domestic terrorism. I can tell you that at the Capitol and in Washington generally, security went up more than it ever before. But after 9/11, we were totally focused on foreign-based terrorism. And that was the focus not only of creating the Homeland Security Department, but then of reforming our intelligence apparatus to deal, our intelligence community, to deal with these new threats. Was domestic terrorism on our minds? It was. But in my opinion, this event on January 6th, really brings it right back to the top. And interestingly, maybe it's a sign that fortunately we did a pretty good job in our post 9/11 reforms. The statistics seem to show that there have actually been more acts of terrorism and violence in recent, let's say, years from domestic terrorism than from foreign-based terrorism. And what's terrorism? Terrorism is the use of violence to achieve a political objective. And clearly, that's what was tried on 9/11, and that's what was attempted on January 6th. And, you know, it's going to happen again, so we have to fight it, and we have to apply all the national strength that we have, and we've applied against the Islamic terrorists, against domestic terrorism extremist groups as well. They threaten us from inside.
So there was a moment in your career when WikiLeaks was rampant and you made phone calls to various web-based services in the United States to discourage them from being allowed to or posting things emanating from WikiLeaks. What's your thought? You were so criticized in some circles for that. I know you felt that that was the right thing to do. What are your thoughts now about deplatforming, about the responsibility, financial or otherwise, that large tech companies have for providing platforms for the propagation of disinformation that has proved so poisonous to our American political dialogue?
This is a really important question. I mean, with WikiLeaks, I was just so angry that they gave a platform and a distribution point for really classified information that was let out and really harmed America's security. And I thought this should be held to account. Our struggles with the internet on this subject are so consistent, unfortunately, with history. And by that, I mean just about every great breakthrough, invention, transformational new idea or capability has really had a very positive side to it. I mean, go back to the creation of fire, or more relevant, the steam engine or telegraph or the ability to fly. They've given us all these great opportunities, but they also brought with them the misuse of those capabilities for hostile purposes, for war, etc. And because the internet has been so transformational, it's not only really improved our lives with education, entertainment, communication, and now operation through media like this of actually our lives, a lot of our lives during the pandemic, and probably a lot of that will remain. But there's a dark side to it, and it is at the causal point of a lot of our big problems. I mean, One of the problems in our political system, the big problem to me is partisanship, partisan and ideological rigidity, and that holds people in Congress and the White House from doing what's always been done in America when we really wanted to get something done or had to get something done. And that was come to the center. Okay, we don't all agree. Let's listen to each other. Let's negotiate. Let's compromise. And let's get at least half of what all of us want, maybe more. So that's not the only cause of the gridlock in our government, social media, et cetera, the internet. But it's really incentivized it. It's also true of hate in our country and terrorism. So let me shortcut it. I think the government ought to either repeal or amend Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which basically gives internet service providers, social media companies a free pass, immunity from liability for pretty much anything they carry except child abuse material, which was an exception carved out.
Let me stop you right there. We'll get back to that conversation on the other side of this break. This is The Takeout with Senator Joe Lieberman. Stay tuned for segment three in just a second.
From CBS News, this is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Joe Lieberman is our special guest. I promised you we're going to get into this conversation about dealing with the pandemic, the work he's done on the Bipartisan Commission on Biodefense. But I want to continue a couple of other things that are related to the here and now. You referred to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, and it does give essentially a carte blanche. There is no liability for platforms for dissemination and placing essentially a foundation beneath things that are disinformation. So you said it should be changed. In what direction? And I don't want you to write the legislation, but what kind of things would be markers of something you think is a necessary remedy?
Yeah. So the social media companies, the internet platforms, have such impact in so many ways. Just think about it. A lot of the activity just leading up to January 6th occurred on the internet. The terrorists communicate on Islamist terrorists on jihadist websites. They're sources of tremendous bigotry and stimulating racism, anti-Semitism, all the rest. And it's not easy for the internet companies. But to give them a total immunity from liability encourages them to be irresponsible, not responsible at all for what's on the internet. So look, one simple answer, maybe not the best, but it would do it, is to just repeal that exemption from liability that Section 230 gives these companies. And what does that mean? It means that they could be sued by victims of whatever is on their platform. They'll probably look for something else less than that. But that is a simple, clean answer. And it ultimately leaves it to our system of law and our courts. The reason I said it's not easy for the companies, the platforms, is this. There are obviously some things that just shouldn't be on there. And they should take them off. I once had a conversation with somebody at YouTube, and I was complaining about the incendiary, violent, stimulating sermons by a particular Islamic cleric who was operating out of Yemen. Eventually, we killed him with a drone. His name was Alaki. And the woman I was speaking to at YouTube said, "Well, you know what? We understand what you're saying, but how can we tell the difference between just the regular sermon he's giving and when he's actually inciting violence?" And I said, it's not easy, but you can do it. I mean, I can tell the difference between whether when a priest or a minister or a rabbi is, of course, none of them that I know are incentivizing violence, but when they're over the line or whether they're just talking from a religious base, and they can do it too.
So in your political career, you lived the tensions within the Democratic Party about progressivism, centrism. You lost a primary and then ran as an independent successfully. So you know a lot of these dimensions of internal Democratic Party politics. They are clearly at the forefront now. Progressives did everything they could to elect President Biden. They want their return on that political investment. They want the filibuster eliminated. In your political careers, I looked through the research. You were on both sides of that. There were times when you used it skillfully to make sure the public option was not part of the Affordable Care Act. There were other times earlier in your career and you were for the abolition, getting rid of the filibuster. Where are you now? And what should Democrats do?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very open in admitting that my position changed on the filibuster. When I got to the Senate in the first few years, it seemed to me that it didn't make sense in our democracy, our republic really, which is majority rules, to have an extra rule in the Senate rules that says you got to get to 60 votes to get anything done. So at different times, I supported attempts step by step or absolutely to end the filibuster. Nothing ever came of it. But I must say in recent years, as I've focused particularly now as chairman of a group called No Labels, which works to try to bring people in both parties together to get things done, I've begun to feel that in the Senate, the 60 vote requirement actually is a major incentive for people of both parties to get together to get something done, because very rarely does one party have 60 votes. And so they got to work across party lines to get something done. That means they have to compromise to pass legislation. Too often today, and we see it again, saw it under President Trump, see it now, President Biden, presidents get frustrated. They do things by executive order that should be done by legislation. And one reason they should be done by legislation is that's what the process of a democracy is supposed to be about. But secondly, it invites exactly what's happening now, which is a new president comes in and by executive order gets rid of all the executive orders of the president before him who had a different set of opinions. So look, I'm glad that it appears that the Senate will now not vote to end the filibuster. I think President Biden and the members of the Senate really should have that pressure to compromise, to come to the center to get some things done. Now, I understand that if it's a total failure and there's no willingness to compromise and it ends up in tribal warfare between the parties in the Senate, there's going to be a very strong temptation among the Democrats to use that 51 votes with Kamala Harris, vice president, to end the filibuster. And I think that won't be good for our country.
And there's another tool. Again, I don't want to get too weedy in this, but it's important for what may or may not happen with the Biden agenda, especially as it relates to the pandemic relief proposal he's put before Congress. Reconciliation is a budget mechanism to get things through without a 60-vote majority. There's tremendous pressure on Senator Schumer, the Democratic leader, the majority leader, to do that sooner rather than later. The White House is trying to give the bipartisan No Labels group some room to see to figure out if it can get to 60 votes. If you're the president or you're advising Joe Biden, how long do you tell him to wait for that?
Yeah, so let's talk about Joe Biden a minute. I know him for a long, long time. I served with him in the Senate for 24 years. And he's basically a center-left Democrat. He's not a left-left or far-left Democrat. And just repeatedly in 24 years I was in the Senate with him, I watched him work across party lines, negotiate compromise to get things done. He did it a couple of times for President Obama when President Obama and frankly, the Democratic leaders in Congress weren't able to do it. And he particularly was successful with Mitch McConnell, who will be a key in whether anything gets done. So, you know, I'd say to Senator Schumer, President Biden, et cetera, reconciliation could be overused. And if it is overused, like the filibuster, maybe not in this 2 years, but give the Republicans an opportunity to come back into the majority in the Senate, and either they'll change the rules of reconciliation or they'll play hard with it just the way Democrats are contemplating. There's a little attitude. I mean, it's hard for, I know most people understand. Basically, reconciliation is about the budget process. And so if you can squeeze something into the budget process, and a lot of the Biden COVID-19 relief package does have budget implications, it can come under that rule that says you don't need 60 votes, you only need 51. Now, just to continue our education in the arcane world of the Senate, there is something called the Byrd rule, as you know.
Not
B-A-R-D, but B-Y-R-D, named for Senator Robert C. Byrd. And it basically says you can't legislate substantively on a budget matter and pass it by reconciliation only 50 votes. So this is not a really a way to go if you can avoid it. And the way to avoid it is to compromise. In my opinion, the COVID-19, there are no labels group of problem solvers in the House and Senate really working now. They were the ones who led to the adoption of $908 billion program at the end of the Trump administration to respond to COVID. They're working hard now at the Biden administration. I hope they can have the same effect. It won't be all that President Biden has asked for, but it'll be a lot that'll help the American people.
That's the voice of Joe Lieberman, our special guest. I promise in segment four, we're going to dig deeply into what to do in the pandemic, biodefense, and the like. I'm Major Garrett. Stay tuned for segment four, The Takeout, in just a second.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
From CBS News, this is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Welcome back. Joe Lieberman is our special guest. And Senator, other Democrats are going to be hanging on your words with this next question before we get to biodefense. So you mentioned the Byrd rule. Thank you for that. I nerd out on this show all the time, even though my audience may not always indulge my nerdy tendencies. But there's now this huge debate in Washington this week. Do you try to jam a increase in the minimum wage from the current federal $7.25 to $15 through reconciliation? John Cornyn, the Senate Republican from Texas, said this very day, Thursday, January 28th, if Democrats do that, it will be as if they abolished the filibuster. It will ruin the Senate for good. Your thoughts?
Well, there is that risk. And, you know, Cornyn he's a conservative Republican, but he's somebody who wants to get things done in the Senate. I've worked with him. He actually has joined our No Labels leadership group. It's a great sign that he wants to work across party lines. So I would, if I were the Democrats in the Senate, I'd listen to what he has to say.
Don't do it. In other words, don't do it.
I wouldn't jam through an increase in the minimum wage. I'd probably support a $15 minimum wage. Frankly, I haven't focused on it. But that's not why I'm saying that. I think that if you jam through something controversial like that, it's going to create a problem for the rest of the 2 years and make it harder for Congress and President Biden to get done a lot of the things that are that really need to get done. Number one, COVID response, and number two, the economy.
All right, here we go. Biodefense. Where are we with the pandemic? You had a report for this bipartisan commission that talked about things like how to distribute a vaccine, getting prepared for it. We didn't do any of that. It wasn't heated. We can't revisit all that history. But where are we now? Where do we need to go?
Yeah, so this report, which we call the Apollo report, Apollo program for biodefense. And incidentally, you said before bioterrorism. It includes bioterrorism and infectious disease outbreaks. Our commission started in 2014. Tom Ridge and I had worked together in response to 9/11. We said there's a real problem that our country's not ready for either a bioterrorist attack or an infectious disease outbreak. And we talked to a lot of the experts. Everybody said, yes, you're right. Here's what you ought to do. We put out a report in 2015. A lot of sympathetic response, but not much real action. So when we got to COVID-19, we really weren't ready. And we've been running to sort of catch up with the disease or get ahead of it. This report this week is trying to take the lessons learned from the last year and put them into a program, Apollo, like the moonshot program of President Kennedy, to set a goal to end pandemics. And we can do it. And you're never going to end infectious diseases. That's just part of human history and the future. But you can get ready to make sure that no infectious disease outbreak becomes a pandemic again, like COVID-19, kills as many people as this has and devastates our economy. And it takes leadership, public investment, might take $250 billion over the next 10 years. But this pandemic is estimated to cost between $10 and $16 trillion. And so it's an investment worth making.
So what does that readiness look like? What would an average American say, oh, I can tell someone's doing something and that's good and that will spare us from the next pandemic? What does readiness look like?
Okay, the beginning of this answer is a little nerdy, so you'll like
good.
It. So here's what I've learned. Tom Ridge, too, a wonderful guy to work with. There are 25 identified families of viruses. So what we would want under this program that we start out doing is develop a vaccine for one form of each of those 25 viruses that's effective. Essentially, put it on the shelf. When an infectious disease outbreak occurs, identify, we could do this now, map the virus. We did it to develop the vaccine against COVID-19. Figure out exactly what its dimensions are, adjust the vaccine that we've already got on the shelf for that family of viruses, and then mass produce it and be ready to mass produce it. Now, here's another lesson learned. We shouldn't force people to frantically go on the internet to try to find a place they can get a vaccine or be tested or wait in line for hours and hours and hours. We have the ability, if we invest in it, to make these vaccines pretty quickly and to make them in a form that we can send to everybody's home in America, and they can give it to themselves in a nasal spray or a pill. Same with the testing equipment. We're moving in that direction now, but believe me, we can have a personal point of contact, self-administered test that we'll send to people. And then obviously we'll be manufacturing that and personal protective equipment, masks and the like, here in the United States. Because when you get into a crisis like this that's global, it's not smart to be dependent on other countries. Because some of them obviously don't want to help us, but a lot of them will be under more pressure naturally to help their own people. So we got to be ready to take care of ourselves. I mean, we really, I want to repeat the bottom line here. Infectious diseases are inevitable, but pandemics based on infectious diseases are not. And if we throw ourselves into a 10-year program, little by little, we're going to make sure that there's never another pandemic like this one in America.
Right. And if you have the tests in your home, if you have the vaccine in your home, or if you know it is readily available at your neighborhood pharmacy, a couple right. of things that strikes me don't happen. One, you're not so uncertain. And two, you're not so prone to anti or non-scientific notions about how to adapt. And I think that's one of the things that's happened in this country. People didn't know what to do. Didn't know what was available, and they jumped into all sorts of voids of misinformation, which created a political discussion in this country about things that we shouldn't have even been fighting over.
You are absolutely right. It's sort of a given. It's like, you know, infants get vaccinated for illnesses. I mean, polio was a fear that hung over my childhood. It's now in some parts of the world it's reappearing, but not here, thank God. Because of the vaccine, the Salk and Sabin vaccines, and we can come to the same point with both flu, influenza, and viruses.
And as I heard you say, that would be about $25 billion at the federal level over 10 years, each and every year, about $250 overall?
Yeah, look, our initial estimate is $10 billion, but I'm trying to be sort of reasonable and say, what if it is 25 billion a year, 250 billion for a pandemic? As I say, this one is going to cost at least 10 trillion. We spend $700 billion a year on defense. I always supported the defense budget generally. This 25 billion is like 2 or 3% of that budget. And for to stop a pandemic, this one has already, as you know, I'm sure, Major, killed more Americans than were killed in all of World War II.
No doubt. So
that's worth investment.
That's the voice of Senator Joe Lieberman, our very special guest this week. For our radio audience, we need to say farewell. For those on CBSN and our beloved podcast platform, stay tuned for the Takeout Outtake Especial. For our radio audience, thanks as always for listening. We'll see you next week.
CBS News. This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Welcome to your Takeout Outtake Especial. I'm Major Garrett. Joe Lieberman is our special guest. You probably heard of him. You know, he ran for vice president, senator for 24 years in the United States Senate, a significant figure in American politics, and still working on things relevant to our future, including biodefense. This is the fun and games segment of our program, Senator. So I have three questions for you. Every guest on this show, now in our fifth year, has taken these questions. Our audience loves the answers. So, in no particular order, whichever order you prefer, most influential book in your life, all-time favorite movie or one of your favorite movies, and if you're going to indulge yourself musically, meaning really get into a good groove, what kind of music, artist, or genre are you most likely to listen to?
Okay. So, the first is the most influential book. Well, you know, I hate to be trite, but it is the Bible.
Oh, really? No, that's not a trite answer on the show. That is never a trite answer. Absolutely not.
You know, it's the source of a lot of wisdom. And obviously, it tells a narrative of the law and the giving of law and values, Ten Commandments, et cetera, that have been important to me. Now, look, I read a lot. I mean, and when I was getting interested in politics, my favorite book was Robert Penn Warren's All the King's Men, also a great movie.
Fantastic, fantastic.
Great novels. But I read eclectically. Right now, I'll give a plug. I don't even know. I don't think he's alive. I never met him. Philip Kerr, English writer, has a series of books about a German detective, police detective, during the 30s, 40s, and 50s, which is really a history of Germany during that time. But anyway, you got to go with the good book.
Absolutely. All right.
I read it every day. I read a little bit every day.
Excellent. Brilliant. Favorite movie or one of your all-time favorite movies?
So this has changed. I definitely went through a period of time where my generation, my favorite movie was The Godfather, 1 and 2. I just watched a remake of 3. Not bad. Better than the original or whatever. But then I don't know what this probably says things about my state of mind. Then I really got entranced with Field of Dreams. Wonderful movie.
Yes,
very
sort
of inspirational. Cried almost every time the father comes out of the cornfield.
Yep.
And it reminded me of my dad who had passed away. But today I feel like I've come back to a tradition, and it's fascinating. I watch it. Not every day, but I probably watch it 3 or 4 times a year, Casablanca. I love that movie because you can figure out why.
Yeah.
So now what was the third one?
Music. What kind of music?
So again, I'm sort of eclectic. My dad, I'm mentioning him now twice, which I'm glad to do, loved opera. So that I'd like to listen to opera. I'm a big Sinatra fan. He doesn't sing opera, in case you didn't know that.
No, he does not.
although he's Italian, and a lot of the great operas are Italian. But so probably to combine it all, I'm a big Bocelli fan. And he does both opera and romance. So it's either Bocelli or Sinatra.
So I have tried a couple of times in my life to immerse myself in opera, and it just never sticks. I don't know why. I've tried. I'll probably try again. But Sinatra does stick with me. And I'll mention an album that you might be familiar with. I've mentioned it on my program before. It's his Live at the Sands, celebrating his 50th birthday. He's with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra and a very young Quincy Jones, who is playing, not producing. And it is amazing. It is Sinatra climbing, trying to climb back into relevance. When he turned 50, the music world was like, oh, Sinatra's over. And he's like, no. And this album is going to prove I am relevant, and you're going to have to deal with the chairman for a long time. And it's spectacular.
No, I agree. And he was, his songs have great lyrics. Now, he didn't write them. Nelson Riddle and others did. But I listened to them. I'm so fascinated by them. I'll give you one last story quickly. And this was how I lived the fantasy. I'm running for office. I think it was Senate one time. It might have been the first time, 1988. There's an Italian there. I'm ethnically focused on Italians today. There's a street festival for one of the saints, I think St. Andrew, in the Worcester Square section in the Haven, which is the old Italian section. I go down there a Saturday night, and there's a concert by a band, Vinnie Carr, now gone, wonderful guy, his orchestra. So he sees me, hey, come on up, Joe. And they start to play My Way. And he says, hey, why don't you sing it? So I was familiar with the lyrics. I did the last chorus. There's probably 500 people there. I finish, they stand up, they cheer. So whenever people were asking me throughout that campaign, hey, would you sing My Way? And believe it or not, flash forward, I don't know how they found this out. I go on Conan O'Brien's show in 2000 when I'm running for vice president. He says, I understand you like to sing. And I say, well, you know, I don't have a great voice, but no, I understand you like to sing My Way. Well, I like it a lot. Would you sing it for us? And anyway, that was my big moment.
We got to find that clip. We got to find that clip. That'll be fun. That'll be fun. Well, as has always been said about Frank Sinatra, this is not an original observation. It's not just the words. It's how he held them, the phrasing that he put around the words. And they were unique. They were Sinatra's own. And everyone's lots and lots and lots of people have tried to replicate what he did with the phrases. No one's come close.
Can't do it. You're absolutely right. And unlike some singers where I have a trouble understanding what are they saying? It's not my hearing. I can't. They're not articulating. You can understand every word that's enough.
Senator, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for the time. Thank you for covering all the topics we've covered. And I hope you are well. Stay well. And we'll keep in touch.
Thank you, Richard. You too. Take care.
See everyone next week. Thanks for listening to The Takeout Outtake Especial.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Fari, Jamie Benson, Sarah Cook, Ellie Watson, Zoe Poindexter, and Jake Rosen. CBSN production by Eric Susanen, Grace Seegers, and Daniel Peebles. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. And for more, go to takeoutpodcast.com. The Takeout is a production of CBS Audio.
If you like The Takeout, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes ad-free on Wondery Plus.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary and it's not boring. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money and maybe more importantly, on your life. I'm going to be your financial coach, someone who brings common sense and an insider's perspective on how to manage your money and your emotions. And I promise we are going to have a little bit of fun along the way. Have a question from retirement to career changes to college funding? Just send us an email at askjill@jillonmoney.com. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.